We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Focus on WILL AM 580, Illinois Public Media. This is your host, Carol Spindell. The producer of Focus is Harriet Williamson, and at the controls today we have Kyle Mabry. We'd like to thank Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, and in particular Jason Gambrell, for setting up the ISDN studio connection that we're using today. In this hour, we're speaking with Dale Maharaj about his book, Someplace Like America, Tales from the New Great Depression. The book was co-authored with photographer Michael Williamson and has an introduction by Bruce Springsteen. It's published by University of California Press. Dale Maharaj is Associate Professor of Journalism at Columbia University. Michael Williamson is a photographer at The Washington Post. The two are longtime collaborators who share a commitment to documenting the everyday lives of hobos, the working poor, and the homeless in America. They have traveled at least 500,000 miles by car and freight train in their efforts to understand the lives of working-class Americans. In the process, they have inspired songs by Bruce Springsteen and won a Pulitzer Prize. Dale Maharaj, welcome to Focus.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Great to have you.
It's been a long 30 years.
I'd like to tell our listeners, too, that if they would like to join our conversation today with a comment or a question for our guest, they can call us at 217-333-9455 at 1-800-22-9455. Or they can email in their comment or question at will-talk@illinois.edu. Now, this book is entitled Someplace Like America because of a homeless man, a vet you met named Crazy Red in the 1980s. Tell us how he got to title your book.
Well, I was sent down to Santa Barbara by an editor. I worked for the Sacramento newspaper at the time with Michael, and they were sweeping the homeless, arresting the homeless. Somebody had murdered a homeless guy, and then a vigilante, a citizen, had put flyers around saying, beware that more homeless will die. So Michael and I took our backpacks. We went down to Santa Barbara, and we slept on the streets with the homeless waiting for the police to sweep. Met this guy named Crazy Red, a Vietnam War vet, and I liked him right away. He said, you know what I want to think about the war on drugs? And I said, no, tell me, Crazy. He says, only way to fight one. I hung out with these guys, and the police came in at midnight around this giant fig tree that's there in Santa Barbara to sweep the homeless. And literally hundreds of people, blankets and sleeping bags, running from the police. And I kind of sputtered at the Crazy Red. I said, how can they do this? And he says, where do you think you are? Someplace like America. And wow. I thought, this stuck with me.
Now, at the heart of your books is this collaboration between you and photographer Michael Williamson. The two of you met when you were working at the Sacramento Bee, is that right?
Yes, I was a young police reporter. I was just 23 years old. Michael was 22. I was told to go meet a photographer to go cover a trailer fire before Christmas. So I was running out of the building to meet this photographer at the photo parking lot, and I hear these steps behind me, and it's Michael. And he passes me. As he passes me, he says, you a runner too? And we went to cover. That was a non-story, really. We ended up at a Wendy's, actually next to the rail yard, where the hobo jungle was, where we would later catch out of. And we found out we wanted to cover these same kind of stories about people, their plight, what they're going through. And, of course, the economy then was not bad. This is 1980. But as the recession of the early 80s started, we just dug in. And long story short, we ended up riding the rails with the new hobos as they sought work when the recession really hit its nadir in 1982.
One of the first hobos you met was an older man who went by the name No Thumbs, and he was really the person who showed you, was he not, how to survive on the freight trains.
Oh, he told me, he says, there's one rule, don't cross anyone, you'll be fine. And I spent 3 days with him. He taught me how to ride the trains. And then Michael and I took off. We wanted to ride with him, with No Thumbs. However, he took off before us. And we saw him in the Roseville Yard 3 days later on a train going the opposite direction. 12 weeks later, he was murdered in the hobo jungle up in Oroville. To this day, it's an unsolved crime. And so it's very dangerous out there. And we were traveling with these new timers who were like babies in the woods. And they're thrust into this world of hobo jungles. And it had a lot of resonance to the 1930s. That was instantly, I had to make that comparison, obviously.
Were you right that you had always been intrigued by the 1930s in America? And you had read a lot about what happened then.
Well, I'd also, my grandparents and my parents went through it. And I was a rapt listener to their stories. I don't know, I was just because of my nature, I wanted to be a storyteller my whole life. And also just to imagine such hard times. And of course, in the 1960s and 70s, when I came of age, they of course would never happen again. That was the mantra. And unfortunately, I think that belief was wrong. The subtitle of our book, Tales from the New Great Depression, I thought we might get actually attacked for it by the people who were more conservative or wanted to deny what's going on, though. But no one's attacked us yet.
Interesting.
For the people we write about, it is a Great Depression.
Now, you point out that what we call the first Great Depression, the 1930s, was actually two recessions with an upturn in between.
Yes, it was actually two great recessions, as we call them today. In the middle, from 31 to 33, it was a great recession. There was a recovery between 33 and 36. In 37, we went right back down because Roosevelt, in the face of Republican opposition, had to pull back on what we call stimulus today. Keynesian intervention with Roosevelt. We pumped money into the economy. There was a WPA. It was a recovery. It was still really bad, but it would have gotten a whole lot worse without it, I believe.
Now, so in the 1980s, you and Michael, both a young photographer, a young reporter, you get a book contract and you hit the road to document what is happening to people in this economic downturn. And one of the first people you meet is a young man that you call Sam. He had owned a successful small business. He was married. He had three children. Then the business lost its biggest contract. He had to file for bankruptcy. The family lost their house. His marriage fell apart. Sam hit the road, and you met him the second day.
Met him in the St. Louis Salvation Army. We were sitting there waiting for guys to come in, and this man walks in, this young man, with an Adidas bag, a racquetball racket, and tennis shoes. And he looked terrified. So we took him out for a hamburger, and he told us his story. He started weeping. And he said, I want to be like a beached whale that goes off and dies. I don't want anybody to see me like this. And, of course, we had to surmount, like, could we, like, follow you? And there was a real, it's immersion journalism where you go out and you travel with people. There's great risks in many levels.
Supposed to intervene in the story as a journalist, are you?
No, but by crossing that line, by saying, we want to travel with you. And at that point, he was suicidal. Had we not traveled with him, there was still a price to pay because this guy wasn't going to make it. He was in real bad shape. So suddenly, it's like, now what do you do? Well, we traveled with him. We rode a freight train to Denver, Pueblo, actually, on Missouri Pacific. And we saw him getting more emotionally stable as we traveled west. I'm not saying it's anything that we did, but he felt like he was doing something finally. He did get a job. And he got back together with his wife. He's the only person that we tracked that we knew who was on the rails, who ended up better. Most of the people ended up worse or dead.
Mm. Now, you and Michael talk about your feelings. You don't want to be exploitative journalists who come in and mine these people's hardships for a story. Michael, around Sam, says he feels uncomfortable taking pictures. So somehow you have to come to terms with your role in all this.
Yes. No, Michael started taking pictures, and he says, look, Sam, we're going to get on the other end of things, and I'll show you what I've shot, and we'll see. He says, oh, no, go ahead. So we ended up going back to California. Michael developed some of the pictures. We drove back to Youngstown, Ohio, and we traveled thousands of miles. It was crazy, freight trains in an old car. We were going back through Denver and where he was working, and we showed him the pictures. He was on an upswing, and he said, sure, you can use the pictures. So we wanted to make sure that Sam was okay with everything. But you still wonder, and I grapple with this with every project, especially this economic story, which we've been covering for 30 years. People trust us with their stories. We better do a darn good job of telling them. And I feel the weight of that responsibility every time I sit down on my computer to tell their stories.
Because sometimes there is a kind of reporting that focuses on individual stories and just kind of drops them into a vacuum. There's no analysis. There's no context. They can become kind of a feel-good, oh, this guy, he got a job, and then that's kind of the end of it.
Well, a lot of the political discourse and reporting today, unfortunately, focuses on numbers. It's sort of like, you know, we're not a society, you know, we're this economy, and we are a society, and we have to get back to that. We have to get back to caring for each other. There's a coldness when you just look at numbers. When a jobs report comes out and says there's X thousand of jobs created, well, when you look at the numbers, they're part-time jobs. They're minimum wage jobs. You're working part-time at McDonald's. There was 1 month earlier this year when 52,000 jobs were created, and all but 2,000 of them were at McDonald's. McDonald's went on a hiring spree. You're not going to raise a family and send your kid to college on that. So you have to go beyond the numbers. And economists and a lot of on the left and right just kind of throw numbers around like they're just abstract. And we want to show the faces behind those numbers. And that's what we desperately tried to do in this book, is to you're going to meet some Americans that you need to meet. And if we understand their stories, maybe those people who are spotting the numbers will react differently to what's going on in the world right now.
Well, you're not only a narrator in the book, you're also a character in the book. You're jumping on trains. You're sleeping in a car. You talk about your own working class childhood. You tell us about Michael's very tough childhood. You mention the response you had and your feelings after your own mother's death. Do you feel this is a more honest approach in which you talk about your own feelings? And the book is a little bit of memoir as well, and you talk about the way you approached these stories than the normal kind of journalistic stance in which the journalist almost pretends that he or she wasn't there. The story just unrolled.
It's. I think there's a dishonesty to that kind of journalism of this literary sort. Now, in a daily newspaper, I would not write that way. And I still write for daily papers on occasion. But in a book or a long-form magazine article, I'm in somebody's life. I've changed the situation. There is no they're going to react differently. They're reacting to me. And when the cops are busting us and I'm the cops threatening to crack me in the head with a billy club, I have to put myself in there. I didn't just threaten someone with a billy club or a reporter. He threatened me. I was scared. I just think there's a moral honesty when you do that. I learned a lot of this from reading some of the greats like James Agee, who I followed in a different book. The writer James Agee was very immersive in his book on the sharecroppers in Alabama, and I kind of copied that model because, again, when people are reacting to me and we're with Don and he's sobbing, telling us, "I want to be like a beached whale," he just says that in the abstract. It's sort of like, well, "Who's he talking to? Why is he so emotional, man?" So I think the reader can understand more. You can't overdo it though. Most of our work is repertorially based. I like to say my work is 20% memoir, 60 or 70% just miserably hard reporting where I work and get to know people, and another 10 or 15 or 20% is policy and context.
Yeah, and in this book, at the beginning of every chapter, you have a double spread page where you have a certain number of those statistics about the economy and the point of view of other kinds of people, people who are in charge, people who make a lot of money, to juxtapose against the stories that you tell in the book. So there is a kind of context for these people's stories in the book.
Oh, there has to be. When we started this work, there were 29,000 Walmart workers in America. Today there's 1.4 million. When we started, there were about almost 750,000 General Motors employees. There's 100 and some thousand, 110,000 now. As Walmart's gone up, GM has gone down. And there's a story in those numbers. And they have to be. You have to have those.
Now, so often in American literature, the road has been depicted as a romantic place, a place you find yourself. And with a photographer as skilled as Michael Williamson, there's also a risk, it seems, that poverty could be made beautiful, because these are in some ways very stunning photos that are in the book. But I was thinking of the picture of the man by the side of the road in Tennessee. He's selling his own possessions in order to get money for food, and he's standing by his truck, and his whole posture is just downcast. It's about defeat. This is not the romantic American road that we have met in literature. This is another American road, is it not?
Yes, this is Steinbeck's road. This is, I know we're on radio, but I want to describe the man on the cover as well. There's another look you see in the book, and his face, he's holding his son. He's in front of the dead Jenny Blast Furnace in Youngstown, a steel mill that made steel for decades and decades. And he's holding his son in his arm. He's maybe 7 years old. And there's a look of a little bit of sadness, just a little bit, but there's also a look of fierce, I'm going to make it. And the viewers, if they want to just, you don't have to buy the book. You can go on Amazon and just, you can look at the face of this man on the cover, and you'll see it when you call it up on Amazon. And there's...
It's true. He looks straight at the camera. He's wearing a dirty old work shirt, chambray blue work shirt. He's holding his son, who's almost too big to be held, but he's holding him up so that their faces are side by side, and they both look just straight into the camera. You know,
and it's
real
like,
I
won't be defeated. I'm not going to let this defeat me. And the Ken was, that's how he was. And there's a resilience among people in America. So, yes, it's the pressing story, but people out there, and they were seeking, and they're seeking new lives now. And that's where we take the book. Where do we go from here as people? Number one, we have to start thinking of each other. And that's disparate people. Ken, the guy in the cover, we've stayed in touch with them. You know, some of these people I've known for 30 years. And they're all saying the same thing about how we have to get together and think as a society. We have to take control of our own lives. That's the starting point for changing this country. And this isn't me speaking. I'm channeling the voice of the various people we've interviewed, that we have to go somewhere better. Now, I think it's going to take 10, 15, 20 years to get to a better place. We're not going to get out of this so-called recession and be just back to quote-unquote normal 2 years from now. That would be naive. I think that's simplistic. It's a process. It took 30 years to get where we are, and it's going to take maybe as many years to get out of where we are.
We're talking with Dale Maharaj about his new book, Someplace Like America, about the working poor in America and the new Great Depression today. If you'd like to call in with a question or a comment for our guest, call us at 217-333-9455, 1-800-222-9455, or email in your question or comment at will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, you and Michael went in the 1980s to Texas looking for the newly homeless, and you met the Alexander family. Now, in this book, 30 years later, it seems hard to believe, you go back and you find them again. So would you tell us about their story?
We met the Alexanders. They had an empty cooler and a few potatoes. They had no food. Jim and Bonnie, the parents, had lost their house to foreclosure in Michigan. They went to Texas. At that point, there were jobs. Jim got work. He got laid off. They ended up living out of a tent in a campground, and they had no food. And we spent almost a week next to them, and we learned their story. And just Jim, a Vietnam vet, so bitter and so angry that he couldn't help his family, desperate for a job. And he had a gun, and he said, if I have to, my kids aren't going to starve. I'll rob a 7-Eleven. I won't hurt anybody. I won't take any money, but I'll take food. Fortunately, we found out later he never had to do that. They pulled out of it. They ended up going back to Michigan. They never went into debt ever again. Jim built his house with his own hands from floor to roof, paid for it as he went. The son, Matthew, who was 11 years old at the time, homeless kid, unfortunately... and he lost his job at a factory in 2001, and he went to join the Michigan National Guard on a suggestion of a friend. He said, we'll get a little bit of money out of the deal. And, of course, 9/11 happened a few months later. And ever since, every 2 years, he has to be deployed in Iraq or Afghanistan for 6 months, and he's got four little kids. So the road has been, you know, they're doing better, but, you know, they're not, like, thriving. They're not. They have not gone back to where they were. Mm-hmm. They're still struggling.
Like many people in America, they're on the edge. We have a caller calling from Effingham. I'd like to welcome you to the program. Hello.
Yes. Thank you very much. This program is deja vu for myself. I am 77 years old. I was born in 1934 and began to understand the world I lived in when I got into grade school. A classmate asked me, "Why do you smell? Why are you dirty?" A girl. Well, I had no idea. You know, I thought, well, what's up with that? Well, then that was the beginning of my understanding. Then I understood about class, not in the classroom, but social classes, and the horrors that were visited upon people like myself by the millions who had no prospect, who had no education prospects. The lower middle class of that time could some send their kids to school, to college, and then they moved on from that. But there was this mass of people at the bottom who could go nowhere. There was no place to go. Then I read The Grapes of Wrath, and I understand that thoroughly, and how the paradigm of capitalism is never going to change. It accedes to a pinnacle where, well, I think now it is 0.5% of the population of the U.S. own all the money. And then they do what they want to do. And back to the 30s again, and Roosevelt, who watched the Depression come back, as your guest just stated. I thought by 1938, and the only thing that bailed out the country was World War II and the armaments production and all those things. And I've lived long enough now to see this whole thing happen again. Now we have two wars, and that's not enough. And as you just stated about a young man who joined the National Guard in order to have an income, and there was a lot of that going on in the 30s. I guess the summation of what I'm trying to say is that nothing is going to change, that the masses of people keep getting larger. I think in the 30s there was 140 million people in this country. Now there are twice that many. And then we have the immigration and all the other things. And I am not anti-immigration. I mean, if my grandparents had not immigrated here to get out of Eastern and Western Europe, their prospects were more limited there. But the population has not exceeded like it has in the U.S. How is it possible that we're going to keep repeating these errors and retaining the capitalist paradigm, and that it's going to get better? I just, perhaps your guests can comment on what I've said, but thank you very much for the time, and I'll ring off and listen. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment, and let's hear what Dale has to say about that.
Well, the caller is spot on with his numbers and his perception, I really believe. You know, capitalism does go to excess, and in the 30s, you know, Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself, kicking and screaming. He put money in people's pockets. We have to get money back in people's pockets. The caller talked about 1% of the population owning a vast majority of the wealth. There's only so many dollars in an economy. They have to be distributed. So what we're seeing on, you know, smaller Wall Street protest, we have to get this discussion going and talk about class. We don't like talking about class in this country. But what really is we have to get money distributed so our economy can function. So I think the caller is just amazingly accurate at what, and he's lived it. And that's the kind of thing I like. He's the kind of guy I like to interview for my projects, people who have lived it. They can say it better than I can say it.
Okay, thank you. We're speaking with Dale Maharich about his book, Someplace Like America. We're going to take a brief break here, and then we'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Franzen talks about his latest novel, Freedom, which has just been published in paperback. It's in part about parenting and the kind of parents who want to be best friends with their children.
As we're talking, I'm realizing the extent to which the book is a lament for the loss of a distinction between children and grown-ups.
Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of Public Engagement, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give is on the web at ccfd.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to Focus on WILL Illinois Public Media. We're speaking with journalist Dale Maharaj about his book, Someplace Like America, published by the University of California Press. Well, you talk about how vulnerable some of these people are, the young man with the racket, which he carries so that he looks like he'll fit in, people on the trains, people who have lost their houses. One of the most troubling stories in your book, I found, was about an entity that took advantage of these people, an entity you called the Foundation that you ran across in Texas.
We'd heard about this group. They would pick homeless guys up on Skid Row in Houston and take them to this kind of a work farm. And you basically committed yourself. Once you signed the paper, you couldn't leave for a month. And so we said we had to go there. So we signed the paper. We went to this, and basically it's a slave camp. They very, very cult-like. They work you night and day. They charge clients $6 an hour. This was back in the 80s. And they paid you in a pack of cigarettes a day and two meals, two hot meals. We had to escape from that camp. It was quite crazy. But the exploitation of the people who are working class and poor. And these camps are all over Texas. There's still these kind of camps in Texas today. It's like they're not allowed to exist anywhere else, but you can find them in Texas.
And they not only wanted to get the labor of these poor men, they wanted to really demoralize them, and they were cruel to them.
Cruel, belittled. But they had these sessions. They called them I forget what they called them, but you would get together in the
group
evening.
Talk sessions.
Group talks, and they would just like berate you and tear you down. You'd go to bed at 1, 2, 3 in the morning after these sessions, and then they would wake you up at before dawn at 4 or 5 a.m. and have make work projects. Then you go out and work all day, come home exhausted. You're basically getting by on a few hours sleep. We couldn't believe this was happening in America to these men. I mean, it was total, absolute defeat. And the people who were there, once they could get out, wouldn't leave because they had nowhere to go.
And they had become completely demoralized and hopeless. It's really a very troubling story that this can go on in modern America. Now, in the 1990s, the country, your first book had gone out of print, I believe. The country didn't really want to think about the recession of the 1980s. They didn't really want to really hear about the fact that some people weren't making it in America. But one person picked your work up, and he ran with it, and that was Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah. The book was out of print for 11 years, and it was our lost dead baby. It had its little run, but you're right. The country didn't want to hear it. But Bruce, I got a call. Michael Williamson. He had a really troubled life. Mother was killed when he was 12, and, just orphanages and foster homes, and he was in California.
And somehow, somewhere along the line, picked up a camera and discovered he could do amazing things with it.
Oh, brilliant things. And by this time we had separated. He was at the Washington Post. We were sort of estranged from each other because the 80s were really hard covering this stuff. It was not easy. But he had won this big award. He was going to be in Sacramento, California. And I said, man, we gotta get together and, have a what the heck happened to us in the 80s. So we went to the hobo jungle and had this really emotional talk. His wife had just found out that day she was pregnant with their first kid. And he was going to go photograph the areas where he grew up in poverty in California for his unborn child. I get home the next morning to Stanford where I was teaching then, and I had a message in my machine when I woke up at 10 a.m., and a woman said, I work for Bruce Springsteen. And I thought, Michael's not going to pull a joke like this. I call it, and it was. And she said, Bruce wants to meet you. So I called Michael and I said, you know, Bruce wants to meet us. He's like, don't pull my leg. Don't. You know, I said, no, really, really. So we ended up a few days later meeting with Bruce at the Shoreline Amphitheater at Neil Young's Bridge Benefit. And he's inspired to write two songs from our first book. One called New Timer, about the old hobo who was murdered and the new timer who was impacted by that. And a really powerful song called Youngstown, about the death of the steel industry in Youngstown. And Bruce, in 299 words, encapsulated 7,000 of my words. I knew he was a good songwriter, but after that experience, I really know he's a great songwriter. And it's a powerful song.
And it reached a lot, the story reached a lot more people, you feel, that once it turned into a song.
Millions that never would have known about the story.
Well, Youngstown, through Bruce's song, but also through your own return visits there, you're from Ohio originally, Youngstown has been a touchstone town for your work and for this project. You went back again and again to the abandoned mill buildings.
It's for 30 years, Youngstown's been in a Great Depression. It never recovered. People told me when I went back there, we've had practice for what's going on. That was we never left it. We've been in the Depression ever since this hit us in the early 80s.
We've got a caller who wants to join us on a cell phone, so let's bring them into the conversation. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for your story. This is wonderful information and the first I've heard of it. But just a quick comment and question. I am a teacher educator at the university level in the area of social studies, an area that's often neglected these days as per testing issues and assessment issues from NCLB. But it's amazing to think of this kind of material being used at the middle and high school level. I think one of the things that's really missing in civics education today is looking at current events, but also looking at social justice issues. And I think we are missing a lot when we don't engage our middle and high school students in discourse and conversation and problem-solving and critical thinking about these very kinds of issues that are affecting many of them and their families and also their friends. It's not such a foreign idea to them. I wondered if you had ever considered working with national organizations such as Southern Poverty Law Center or others to pilot this book in public schools as a way to, for lack of a better term, you know, kick the social studies curriculum in the pants here and get some real advocacy issues out there in the schools. And I'll leave the air to listen to your response. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My gosh, that's a brilliant idea. I'd be for that.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen the materials they put out in through their Teachings Tolerance series, the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Oh, I have. Of course I have.
But they do provide free materials for school teachers.
You know, it's a great idea. You know, the caller is right. We have to get civics back into the discussion here. And again, this is we have to think about each other. And so the middle school level is a great place to start with that stuff.
It is. Kids are very curious at that age, and they're really looking around them, and they're wondering how the world got this way. Why is it the way I see it around me? So I agree with you and the caller. That's a great time to get kids asking these questions and thinking about these questions. In schools, if we think about schools today, hunger is much more prevalent in American schools than we probably would like to admit. And you and Michael ask in this book about how to portray hunger, how to photograph hunger. You meet children who have a hard time paying attention in school.
Oh, over and over. Michael and I cannot count how many times we followed people home from food banks at the end of the month when their money's run out, and they open the refrigerator and it's empty and they've got children. You don't know how that, every time it hits us, oh my gosh, there's hungry kids. And a lot of people might dismiss these people. So I took one of their lives apart in the book. There's a woman named Maggie Fonseca in Texas. She works for the state of Texas. At the time, she made $10 an hour. She was a single mom. Her husband left her. And the girl was born with a congenital problem and had all these surgeries, and her health insurance was horrible. And I met her in a food bank line, and I went to her house. She had no food. It was her first time ever getting charity food. And I took her budget apart, okay? I said, Maggie, I want to ask you, you know, let's go through it. And she said, I want to help you, Dale. And we went through the list, what she spent, how she spent it. She had a Habitat for Humanity home. Her mortgage was only $365 a month. She was very careful on her budget. She cooked everything from scratch, no fast food. And she was in the hole every month. And so I put her budget in the book. And there it is in black and white. There's no wasteful spending on this woman's part. Working hard. She ended up, by the time I got to know her at the end, working three jobs. Mm-hmm. She worked for the state of Texas. She baked pies on the side. And she did a waitressing a couple nights a week. That's, she could barely make it. And the only way she made it was her grandmother babysat her girl. If she had to pay for a babysitter, she couldn't have done it.
And you point out, too, the tremendous good that school lunch programs do to help a lot of these children.
Stunning, stunning good. Kids, teacher after teacher has told me, if these kids didn't get this food, in the morning they can't focus because they're so hungry. I have met teachers who bring in cereal for their kids with their own money. Then the school lunch kicks in, and in the afternoon the kids can actually learn because they can focus. This is America, and this isn't the country I was born into, or, you know, the ideal of the country I was born into. We had problems when I was born in the 50s, of course. Black children in the South weren't doing so well. But we had the war on poverty, and we were on a good track there into the mid-60s. And then ever since then, we've been on a decline. And it's sad. It bothers me, and I've been doing this for 30 years, and I still walk into these situations, and I get emotional. Because it just amazes me that we allow this to happen in this country.
And yet, many Americans who have never experienced poverty firsthand or have never, as you have, documented it, run up against it, they have a lot of misconceptions about who these people are, how many people are on welfare, who they are. These misconceptions seem to be rife in America today.
Well, so many people aren't on welfare or food stamps. Sam, we talked about earlier, I'm not getting food stamps. We said, Sam, you need them now. If you feel guilty, pay more money in taxes than you owe for a few years. But you need food stamps now. We convinced him to get food stamps. Maggie, the woman in Texas, she has two girls now. And I saw her again. She doesn't qualify for food stamps. And yet she still has to go to the food bank and still doesn't have enough food to eat. So people are proud, and most people are reluctant to take even food stamps, which are not like welfare, because they have pride. So I don't know. I don't know why people demonize the folks who are struggling. It's very easy to demonize people who are faceless. And that's why, as I say, if we talk to each other and start thinking about each other, it's harder to put down somebody you know or you can see their face, look into their eyes.
We have a caller on line one in Champaign. Hello, are you there on line one?
Yeah, hello. You hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
I have a few things here. One is that actually you were talking about, the role of a journalist. I look at what the author does as being an anthropologist, and there are fields of anthropology where they actually go and live with the people and observe and all that kind of thing. So. There's some great value of that type of research, so I would view it that way. Another issue is the undocumented worker. You're talking about the camps. I was thinking about that in Texas. Well, that happens to them because what happens there is that the employer, who does almost anything, not that particularly wants, but well, you know, in terms of long hours, not. Below, Illinois, I think, is maybe $8.25 an hour. Will pay less than that. Work long hours. If something happens, if they get hurt, then, you know, they go back to Mexico or some other place, you know, because they're not, they maybe can do emergency, you know, that kind of thing. Another one was that I really second my vote, you know, for the fellow that talked previously about into the schools. I'd like to see it also at the university level where maybe they could go on tour, the photographer and himself, across universities and get this story out. I think it's an important one. So any of those suggestions, whatever, a program that's needed, and I'll just go off and let you talk these issues, okay?
All right. Well, thanks very much for your comments and your questions. Any of those you want to pick up on there?
Well, I like that. Your callers want me doing a lot of work. That's great.
They've got a job for you here.
And I don't. That's the kind of work I like. So, these are all wonderful points. And I'm trying to do as much as I can to get this story out there. And there's a film in the works on the book, a feature film, and we get that off the ground, that'll have a lot more impact. You know, Bruce is going to, you know, still sings Youngstown at shows. It's just large ways and small. I think, you know, each of us, not just me, but each of us, we have to think in terms of what we can do to foster a sense of community in society. There's many, many ways to do that.
Okay. Well, with that point, let's go to a caller in Urbana. Hello. Are you there?
Yeah.
Hi.
So I think this is a really interesting discussion being had. I'm a political science graduate student at the University of Illinois, and I've done some research on media portrayals of poverty in the country. And so basically what I was looking at with a professor back at Purdue, while I was actually still an undergraduate, was whether the media sort of portrays poverty in racialized terms. And because there's been a lot of research that has shown that people are against welfare because welfare has become a racialized issue. And basically what has been found is, starting as far back as the 1980s when the research first began, is that the media consistently over-portrays African-Americans and Latinos as a total proportion of poverty in America. And basically what we found is more than 50% of pictures of poor people in five major news magazines were African-American, whereas the true percentage is only about 20-ish percent. And really, Caucasians are the majority of the poor in this country. So I was wondering if you could comment on that as a central driving force behind people's negative views and demonization of those on welfare.
Okay. Thanks so much for the question.
It's a great question, and this caller is accurate, too. Yes, his numbers are very spot on. As a writer, you have to think about that. I want to represent everybody in this book, in all of our work, not just this book. But showing whites in these situations is actually, because they numerically are the most people on welfare, the most people in poverty. And you have to think about that as a journalist. And you have to think about it on the other end of the terms, too. I'll never forget one time Michael was photographing a parade in Sacramento. It was a Sunday assignment, and they told him, your photo's on page one. And it was 4th of July. And it was this African-American woman with her two kids, and they all had flags. And it was the most amazing picture. And Michael took the picture of them. And the woman said, what are you doing? She said, I'm taking a picture for the newspaper. And I normally can't guarantee this, ma'am, but this picture I will guarantee you will be on page one tomorrow. And she says, it ain't going to appear. They're not going to show me with my kids on page one. A person like me, which meant a black woman. Sure enough, that ran the next day. Michael got this tearful phone message. Thank you for showing an African-American, you know, not just, you know, getting arrested. Michael, when he photographs consciously every day of his life, he still works for the Washington Post, thinks of these things, not to misportray reality, but to portray reality as it is. And as a journalist, you have to take this into consideration. Otherwise, you're not doing your job.
Well, you and Michael have also spent a lot of time in post-Katrina New Orleans. And if we're going to talk about race and poverty and people's perceptions of it and people's reactions, some people feel that we've let New Orleans languish and go down because so many of the affected people, the people who need help, are African American.
Absolutely. It's so tragic. There's 70,000 abandoned buildings in New Orleans. They estimate 12,000 squatters living in them. Most of them are black or American Indian or minorities. And I call it America with a lid ripped off. People naively thought, once New Orleans happened, we'll finally deal with poverty in this country, and we didn't. And I really do think that the face of poverty as the African American made a lot of people just, you know, turn off to it, and it's very sad. It's a national tragedy what is going on in New Orleans. But, you know, New Orleans really isn't any different than Detroit. Detroit and New Orleans are the same, except one has palm trees. one was destroyed by nature, and the other was destroyed by an economic act. And there's African Americans in both communities, and so they're sister cities in many ways.
We have another caller calling from Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to say thank you so much for having this program today. I'm really, really getting a lot out of this. It's wonderful. And I wanted to say, are you there?
We are listening, absolutely.
Oh, I'm sorry, okay.
Go right ahead.
I wanted to say on the issue of race, I think it's just interesting in this country how racism, it seems to me, if it benefits anybody, it benefits the upper 1% of the population, the wealthy. And it always cuts the throats of the lower classes, and especially the lower classes of whites in this country. It happened over and over in union busting, which is, you know, throughout our history. The lack of unity between the two races would end up destroying their ability to be effective in unions. And in this issue of public welfare, if there is a stigma concerning the issue of welfare because of the racial issue, then the more the poverty level rises into the lower class and even middle class, it's cutting the throats of then white people who cannot get assistance because of that stigma. So it's just interesting to me how that is such a problematic issue for us.
Thanks so much for your call. I don't know if you want to comment, Dale.
Yeah, the issue of race and class is intertwined in a very, in a way that would be a whole other hour program. But class is something we don't like talking about in this country unless it's preceded by the word middle. Look at the reaction to Warren Buffett's proposal that his secretary shouldn't pay more percentage-wise in taxes than he. Of course, Obama has embraced that, and you know, the wealthy and the Republicans are crying class warfare. And as Buffett once said a long time ago, he says, yeah, there's class warfare in this country, and my class is winning.
So, he should know.
And he should know.
He knows very well. He's the expert. We have another caller calling on line two from Savoy. Let's get them into the conversation. Hello, are you there in Savoy?
Yes, I just wanted to say that I thought I learned a lot from this program. I think the guest is a very good observer and apparently a good reporter and a good writer maybe too. But I think he's not a good analyst, and that he should stay out of the commentary business and just stick to the observing and reporting. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. You want to respond to that, Dale?
Well, just reporting is without context is pretty empty. So maybe he doesn't like what I say, but, I didn't write my book for him then, I guess.
You talk about the 30-year war in this country that you've reported on the poor and the fact that the number of poor are increasing. Among people 18 to 29, 37% are unemployed. Now, that's a shocking number. And I think we have to start asking, what can we do about that as a society? How can we create jobs?
That one is very difficult. We're not going to, you know, push a button and have a bunch of jobs for these young people. But I would like to see some kind of Works Progress Administration type effort. Conservatives will say that the WPA really didn't stop the Depression. And they're right. It didn't end the Depression. But I had an uncle. There was a WPA and the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CS. And he went into the CS. It was government program jobs. He built walls in Idaho. He built bridges in national parks. Those walls and bridges are still there today. And he learned a skill in construction. And when the Depression ended after the war, he ended up being a very productive member of society as a construction worker. And he paid more in taxes than we invested in him. And it was an investment. And so we will lose a generation of these young people. The former New York Times columnist Bob Herbert wrote about this about 2 years ago, how you have to be trained to work. And if you lose that training, you lose a generation of workers. And we're losing all these young people. And so I would like to see some kind of WPA-style program that would employ these kids and give them skills and help rebuild our country. Give us something back, too.
Now, you also speak with some people, and you have some very helpful stories. They're reviving the idea of the truck farm, and they're becoming urban farmers and making a living that way.
There's Sherry Harvell in the book, a single black mom in Kansas City, Kansas, who worked in a bank, hated her job, and ended up, she makes most of her income now urban farming on plots in abandoned plots in Kansas City. She's making far less money than she did, but she's bartering with her fellow urban agriculturalists for chickens and things that she can grow, and eating extremely well, and kind of taking control of her own life through farming in an urban setting. And I just find that wonderful. Sherry has control of her life now that she didn't have before.
You also tell at the end of the book the story of Youngstown, in which they're destroying some empty neighborhoods in order to save others. A little bit of hope there in Youngstown and those stories.
Yeah, people are rebuilding. There's good things going on in this country. And I think, you know, if we can look at them as journalists and highlight them, we could all learn from them.
Well, we're going to have to end it there. I'd like to thank all our listeners today on Focus. I'd like to thank the callers who've called in. Michael Williamson wasn't with us, but we'd like to thank him for his beautifully bleak photos in this book. It's called Someplace Like America, The New Great Depression. It's published by University of California Press. Thank you, Dale Maharaj, for your work and for being with us today on Focus.
And likewise, thank you, Carol. And if you lose that training, you lose a generation of workers, and we're losing all these young people. And so I would like to see some kind of WPA style program that would employ these kids and give them skills and help rebuild our country. Give us something back, too.
Now, you also speak with some people, and you have some very helpful stories. They're reviving the idea of the truck farm, and they're becoming urban farmers and making a living that way.
There's Sherry Harvell in the book, a single black mom in Kansas City, Kansas, who worked in a bank, hated her job, and ended up, she makes most of her income now urban farming on plots in abandoned plots in Kansas City. She's making far less money than she did, but she's bartering with her fellow urban agriculturalists for chickens and things that she can grow, and eating extremely well, and kind of taking control of her own life through farming in an urban setting. And I just find that wonderful. Sherry has control of her life now that she didn't have before.
You also tell at the end of the book the story of Youngstown, in which they're destroying some empty neighborhoods in order to save others. A little bit of hope there in Youngstown and those stories.
Yeah, people are rebuilding. There's good things going on in this country. And I think, you know, if we can look at them as journalists and highlight them, we could all learn from them.
Well, we're going to have to end it there. I'd like to thank all our listeners today on Focus. I'd like to thank the callers who've called in. Michael Williamson wasn't with us, but we'd like to thank him for his beautifully bleak photos in this book. It's called Someplace Like America, The New Great Depression. It's published by University of California Press. Thank you, Dale Maharaj, for your work and for being with us today on Focus.
And likewise, thank you, Carol.
Today's programs are made possible by Silver Creek in downtown Urbana, serving lunch and dinner every day with a brunch on Sunday. For 20 years, Silver Creek has been bringing to the table freshly baked artisan breads, prime steaks and chops, fresh fish and pasta dishes, and delightful pastries made by Silver Creek's pastry chef.
And at a couple minutes before 12 o'clock, this is Jeff Bossert with this market update. Looking right now at Kansas City hard red winter wheat, it's at 707, down 33. From Chicago, December wheat at 612 and 3 quarters, down 41 and 3 quarters. March, 649 and a quarter, down 36 and a half. December corn, 592 and a half, down 40. March, 605 and 3 quarters, down 40. May, 613 and a quarter, down 40. November soybeans, 11.87 and a quarter. That's down 42 and three quarters. January, 11.98 and a quarter, down 43. March, 12.06 and three quarters, down 43. May of next year, 12.14 and three quarters, down 41. October soybean meal, 3.06, down 10.90. December, 309.90, down 11.60. October soybean oil, 50.18, down 145. December soybean oil, 50.47, down 149. October live cattle, 121.17 and a half. That's up 77 and a half. December, 122.20, down or up 95. October feeder cattle, 140.85. That's up 145. November, 142.42 and a half. That's up 52 and a half. October lean hogs, 92.95. That's up 257 and a half. And December, 87.60, up 162 and a half. The Arbaum gasoline at this hour is at 2.